I drink water all day long, as well as lots of tea. My favorites are lemongrass, chamomile, and mint, ideally made with fresh chamomile and mint leaves from my own little garden. But it all depends on how I'm feeling. If I'm getting sick, for example, I'll drink fennel tea, or prepare a honey lemon ginger concoction on the stove. Otherwise, I always drink my tea straight, without honey or sugar. By the late afternoon, Renata, our babysitter, has picked up Benny and Vivi from school, and from now on, it's all about my family. I make it a point to talk to Renata in front of Benny and Vivi so that they know we talk about them, and to teach them not to treat me one way and her another. Sometimes I run a bath for the kids, or else they take a shower, and then it's time for dinner, with Benny and Vivi usually helping set the table. During the football season, Tom is home by 6 p.m., unless he's playing an away game, and our dinners usually last about an hour. I always ask Tom about his day, but usually the conversation revolves around the kids. After dinner, we usually FaceTime Jack, Tom's son from a previous relationship who I call my bonus child, to check how he's doing and say goodnight. If Jack is visiting, he takes his older brother status seriously. Benny always wants to make everyone laugh. Vivi is the one who laughs the hardest and who clearly loves her two brothers. She is their greatest cheerleader and wants to feel she's part of the gang. After dinner, the kids vanish to watch Portuguese cartoons on TV, which gives Tom and me some alone time to talk about our day, sometimes over another cup of chamomile tea. Both Benny and Vivi speak fluent Portuguese, Benny with a slight accent, and Vivi as if she were born in Brazil. Jack is understanding Portuguese more and more, and I love it when he tries to speak, because his accent is so cute. When I was growing up, my parents spoke German exclusively to each other, though never to us, as they wanted to keep whatever they said between them. Today, after years of traveling, I've become fairly fluent in four languages. Benny and Vivi may be American and born in Boston, but they're Brazilian too. Neither of my parents speaks English all that well, and my nieces and one of my sisters don't speak English at all, and it's important to me that my children are able to communicate with my family. So every summer, I take Benny and Vivi on a two-week holiday with my entire family, where we speak only Portuguese. I like to think I'm raising my children to be citizens of the world. I also believe that the more we can talk to people in their own language, the more we will understand one another. When I think about my daily schedule, I realize that almost every moment of the day feels like a ritual, and I really want to create a series of special small moments. It's up to all of us to capture time, to give it meaning, and to be present and appreciative for every moment we're alive. This is why making a big deal out of little moments matters a lot to me. Stretching my body the moment I wake up, being conscious of my breath, lighting a candle, meditating, singing with my kids on our way to school. More than anything, these moments are about appreciation. My goal is to be present, to feel and experience my life deeply. Even if what I'm feeling overwhelms me or sometimes makes me burst into tears, which I do now and then. To live a full and meaningful life with the awareness of what's happening around me, and to inspire my children to live that way too. Bedtime is another ritual. When Tom is home, he kisses the kids goodnight and sometimes he tells them a story. At bedtime, I love reading out loud to each child. Then I do something I've done since Benny and Vivi were infants. I give them each a quick foot massage using aromatherapy oils, of which I have an entire pharmacy. 5 minutes of foot rubbing really calms them down and makes us feel close. The last thing I do before saying goodnight is to remind them to pray to their guardian angel. I often wait outside their rooms, listening to them saying their prayers. And it melts my heart every time. I generally fall asleep later than Tom. During football season, Tom likes to be in bed by 9 p.m. After brushing my teeth and reading a few pages of a book, I check my phone to see if there's anything urgent, slip it into airplane mode, and reset my wake-up alarm. That's my day. It varies if I'm traveling in Brazil or New York or on the West Coast, or sometimes even when I'm in Boston. If I'm in another city for a photo shoot, I carry out some variation of the same routine. I get up at 6 a.m., meditate, and work out, even if it's for only 20 minutes, because I know that as the day goes on, the less motivated I'll be to exercise, and after a long day of work at the studio, I know it won't happen. If I'm doing TV commercial work, the day can go as long as 12 hours. If I'm doing magazine work, it lasts anywhere from 8 to 10 hours. As I said, I check my phone rarely when I'm working, though as soon as I'm done, I always FaceTime Tom and the kids. Before going to bed, I like to take a shower, especially if they used lots of product and my hair looks crazy. I am usually under the covers no later than 10 p.m. I need at least 7 hours of sleep, 8 if I can get it. Thankfully, I've never had any trouble falling asleep. I'm usually exhausted at night, and as soon as I put my head on the pillow, I am gone. People often tell themselves stories to explain who they are and how they got that way. One of my stories is that I developed my work ethic from sharing a small house with 5 sisters and from watching my parents work hard as they did. Another one I tell comes from being a middle child and a twin on top of that, who never felt all that special and who never wanted to disappoint her parents, which turned into a desire to not disappoint herself. There's truth to both of those stories, but I also know that being disciplined and being intense about that discipline is just who I am. I think I was born that way. Even if I did grow up as one of 6 sisters to parents who worked very hard, and even if I pushed myself to do well in school and in sports, those things were just arenas where I could test and play out a trait already inside me. Joseph Campbell once wrote, "You become mature when you become the authority of your own life." In my case, for whatever reasons, I took on that authority starting when I was young. When I tell people I never wanted to let my parents down, that was true. It still is. But what I'm really saying is that I never wanted to fall short of my own expectations. If discipline doesn't come easily, what's the best way to create it? It begins with self-awareness, and self-awareness is a process. It's not something we're born with. It's something we develop over time. I know this much. The better you know yourself and what you're good at and what brings you joy, the easier it is to focus on what you want to manifest, which in turn makes it easier for you to manifest what you want. What do you want? What works best for you? Are you at your best at a certain hour, on a certain kind of day, in a certain environment? Do you make it a point to expose yourself to positive words, positive images, inspiring people, inspiring ideas? If you spend all day on your phone, for example, reading the news and making yourself anxious or scared, or if you set unfair goals for yourself, I believe you're setting yourself up for failure and unhappiness. As I said, if I tell myself I'm going to meditate in the morning for 30 minutes, but every day I get interrupted, the problem isn't my children wanting their breakfast or the dogs wanting to go outside. It's me being unrealistic about what's going on around me. I think of discipline as the voice of a parent or an authority figure inside us. It keeps us answerable for our actions. But if that voice isn't strong enough inside you, consider creating a parent on the outside. Find another way to track your progress, to keep yourself accountable. This is something I've done with my own children. Vivi and Benny are very young and still have a lot to learn. Who doesn't? I know I do. To help them organize their routine and to give them tasks and responsibilities, the solution we came up with was a whiteboard. The board hangs in our kitchen. It replaced one that had actual magnetic stars on it, but when Vivi began gaming the system and covering her side of the board with as many stars as could fit, we found one with a black pen and an eraser. The board first appeared during a short-lived stage when Benny started talking back to me. Whenever I'd ask him to do anything, His attitude was that I knew nothing, and even if I did, I was wrong. So Tom and I decided to address the situation head on. I told Benny it was okay if he got angry or frustrated about the rules we set, but he couldn't treat me disrespectfully. If he was mad at me, he had to tell me. Benny admitted that he wasn't always nice to me, and he said that he was sorry. Then he came up with the idea of the whiteboard. Here's how it works. When we notice that the kids need more structure, we ask them questions at dinner. How were their manners? Did they say please and thank you? Did they look their friends and teachers in the eye when talking to them? Were they kind to their friends and to each other? If they had a friend over that day, did they tidy up their bedrooms and put away their toys afterward? After meals, did they bring their dishes over to the sink? When I asked them to do something, did they do it? If the answer to the question is yes, the child who answered it gets a star. Stars can be given, but they can also be withheld. If Benny, say, pinched his sister, or if Vivi forgot to be a good hostess during her playdate, they don't get a star. Instead, we talk about the things they can keep working at, whether it's being a better listener or working on their patience. We keep a list of expectations on the board so they understand that everything is a work in progress. The star system has really helped. Even better, the kids are becoming much more at ease with their emotions and with who they are as people. Benny will tell us that he ate a cookie before dinner, for example, and also that he's afraid I will get angry. Yes, he'll lose a star, but rather than getting mad, I thank him for being truthful, which encourages him to be honest. What matters most to me is that we've helped create an environment where our kids feel safe to express their feelings and to have real conversations, and that they know that their dad and I are walking with them side by side, but not carrying them. I remind my kids that we are all learning together. I'm 38 years old. I've never been a parent before. As much as it's my job to teach them, they're also teaching me. So what are some of the things I could be doing better? We try to give our children what we got from our own parents growing up. If we're lucky, we get to fill in parts that, for whatever reason, were left blank for us. When I was growing up in Orizontina, there were six of us girls at the dinner table. Six voices rising up to talk or laugh or disagree at once. One day my dad made a rule. If one of us had something to say, we needed to raise our hand. With all those children, my mom also didn't have time to read us books before bed. She hardly had a second to herself. Sometimes I would get up in the middle of the night and see her at the kitchen table, still working, a calculator with rolls of paper billowing out of it in front of her, trying to make the figures add up. Haki, Fofa, Pachi, Gabi, Fafi, and I had to figure out a lot of things by ourselves. In some ways, we were children raising children. We had to learn how to negotiate, how to agree, how to fight fairly. But never once during my childhood did I ever feel that I was missing out, or that I lacked anything at all. How could I lack or miss out on something I never knew existed? I felt, and still do, that I had the best childhood in the world. I'm aware that my circumstances today are different from the ones faced by my parents. The job I began working at when I was 14 and over the next 23 years allows me more time for my children. I can read to them, massage their feet, teach them how to breathe and how to express their feelings. I can capture as many fast-moving moments as I can while there's still time and experience them as they happen. In 2017, I was asked to give the opening speech at Rock in Rio in front of an audience of around 100,000 people. For people who don't know it, Rock in Rio is one of the biggest music festivals in the world. Over the years, it has featured acts like Beyoncé, Prince, Rihanna, George Michael, R.E.M., the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Dave Matthews Band, Coldplay, and U2. The call came right around the same time that the president of Brazil, Michel Temer, announced that the government had abolished an enormous national reserve in the Amazon, Renca, in order to open up the region for mining. As many as 9 natural, environmental, and indigenous reserves would be negatively affected. I've been working on the protection of the environment since 2004, when I visited the Amazon and saw up close how the indigenous Indian tribes, especially young children and elderly people, were getting poisoned and even dying because of the pesticides and the mercury in the river where they bathed and fished. My heart was heavy when I saw this reality. I saw firsthand how environmental toxins were directly affecting their lives, but the truth of the matter is that contaminated water and soil affect all of us. As far as I'm concerned, any attack on nature is an attack on all of life. As a mother and a nurturer, my natural instinct is to protect. My reaction to the Brazilian president's new law was outraged, followed closely by, "I have to do something. We can't let this happen." A group of us put up such a protest on social media that the Brazilian government said it was going to postpone the discussion to another time, subject to an extended debate. When Marcus, a friend of mine and one of the co-creators of Believe Earth, who knew Roberto Medina, the creator of Rock in Rio, asked me to open the concert, I said yes. But I hung up the phone feeling terrified. I'd never given a speech in front of 100,000 people. I'd never even written a speech as important as this one. A few minutes later, I became aware of something inside me. Determination. Discipline. If something was scaring me, I knew it was up to me, only me, to work through my fear. If I wanted to succeed, I had to do the work. A big part of me wanted nothing more than to stay home and be safe. I also worried that since the audience was coming to Rock in Rio to hear music, Ivete Sangalo, Maroon 5, The Who, and Guns N' Roses were all performing that year, they'd get angry when I came out to give a speech. What if they don't listen to me, I thought, or boo me, or yell at me, or throw things at me? It doesn't matter, was my next thought. Get out of your head. Just do it. If you don't stand up for what you care about, then you're complicit. It didn't matter that I'd never written a speech in my life. It didn't matter how long I had to sit there in front of my laptop before the words came out. It didn't matter how frightened I was, or how stupid I might look, or the 100 other reasons why it was a bad idea to put myself in this situation. I became aware that for now and forever, my bigger purpose was love. It wasn't about me. I was speaking in service to a cause more important than myself. I was being tested, and one of the tests involved courage. It wasn't the first time I'd appeared in public before an audience that size. I'd walked the longest runway of my life, more than 400 feet, at the opening ceremony of the 2016 Rio Olympics, before hundreds of millions of people watching on television, an experience that also terrified me, before I did it. That night, I remember feeling like a speck of light being carried by the energy of the crowd. But Rock in Rio would be different. At the Olympics, I could sense the audience, but the stadium was so dark I wouldn't be able to see anyone. Plus, this time, instead of walking, I had to talk. I knew Rock in Rio wouldn't be easy for me, even if I'd appeared in front of a big audience before. Because, let's face it, talking is a much bigger responsibility than walking. But if I hadn't done the walk, I couldn't have done the talk. Remembering that helped steady my confidence. I believe that when you face a challenge, you have to rise up to meet it. Then the next challenge that appears is a little harder, but then you rise up to meet that one. Isn't that how we grow? When I got to the end of my speech, I wrote, "When we can dream, when we're able to imagine, we can create a better world." I wanted to end with a song, since I was at a rock festival after all. But what song? My sister Fafi, who was sitting next to me, said, "What about Imagine by John Lennon? Doesn't that sound like the message you've been writing about and want to communicate?" Right then, I knew that Imagine would be the perfect song to conclude my speech. Also, how incredible would it be if Ivete Sangalo, one of the most popular singers in Brazil, who is not only an amazing musician, but also a dear friend, a wonderful woman, and a beautiful human being, could begin singing the song when I was done speaking. When I found out that Ivete would be coming on stage right after me as one of the concert's headliners, I called her and told her I needed her help. "I'm with you," Ivete said. I was so excited. Everything was coming together. The night of the festival, my emotions were all over the place. Before I went on stage, the woman in charge of the event tried to be helpful. She told me, "Don't worry, even Bono and Coldplay get nervous when they play here." Funny, but hearing that only made me more nervous. So I took a moment for myself. I closed my eyes. I took the time to create an intention. I asked God, "Please allow the audience to feel what I'm feeling. Let them feel my heart." I wanted to connect with them. I wanted them to feel that we are all connected, all one. It gave me a rush, a strength, and the confidence I needed to go on. Then I went out on the big stage. I talked for several minutes. I didn't talk about the Amazon or about mining or about any other problems facing the country. Not directly, that is. Instead, I talked about the power of the collective, and about hope, and about all of us standing together. At one point, my emotions overtook me, and I started crying. Then Ivete appeared. She gave me a big hug and started singing. She'd asked me to sing with her, and though I hadn't planned on it, I felt too shy. When the moment came, I couldn't help it. It was more karaoke-style singing on my part than anything else, especially when you find yourself duetting with a singer like Ivete. And Imagine did the rest of the talking. What can ever prepare you for something like that? There's no manual. There's no rule book. You just do it. You put aside your fears. You tell yourself nothing is going to stop you. A night like that is no different from any mountain you know you have to climb, so you lace up your boots and you climb the mountain. You learn from the experience of doing it. When the next mountain appears, you're a little better, a little sharper, a little more practiced at making your way to the top. That's how discipline has served me my whole life. It hasn't just helped me accomplish what I set out to do. It's helped me see how I can do more. I just have to trust myself and go for it. If anything, I remind myself sometimes that I need to relax my own sense of discipline and to be gentler and more compassionate with myself. To some people, I probably might come off as a little obsessive or overly driven. I'm working on it, and becoming a parent has made me much more forgiving with myself. Once I was someone for whom nothing was good enough. I wasn't good enough. In 2015, when Taschen published a book to celebrate my 23 years in fashion, I remember Giovanni Bianco, the book's art director, asking me, "Giselle, when did you have time to go to the bathroom? It's so obvious that for years you didn't have a life." He was right. Back then, I didn't have much of a life. It was only when I started going through the thousands of photos to select the 300 or so that appeared in the book that I finally got a sense of just how hard I'd worked. I feel appreciation many times a day, but those photos jogged my memory in other ways. For the first time, I could see just how far a middle twin from a small village in southern Brazil had come. I remembered all the people I met, all the conversations I had, all the feelings I felt, all the countries I visited. For the first time ever, I gave myself a pat on the back. "You did okay," I thought. "You did it. You made it to the other side. And today, you're not only sane, you're stronger, wiser, and more confident. Good girl." Chapter 2. Challenges are opportunities in disguise. I've always been an intuitive person. When I left home, I usually had a pretty good sense of how to stay safe and make wise choices. Yet, like everyone, I've had circumstances in my life that weren't going well. Sometimes an event or a situation occurred that was simply unacceptable, a conflict or a confrontation, and then I had no choice but to change. Our relationships help us grow because they mirror the best and worst of ourselves. When I reflect on my life, I can clearly see that the times that I've learned the most and made the most positive changes have also been the most difficult times. These were situations when I made poor choices, but I question whether they really were mistakes, or rather just experiences and opportunities to learn. Today, I'm convinced that every challenge I've ever faced turned out in the end to be an opportunity in disguise, one that in time lifted me to a better place, making me more aware and also stronger. Inevitably, when I think back to a time in my early 20s, I remember that I felt so helpless that I questioned whether I wanted to live. I was on a hamster wheel, and yet I didn't even know it. I was 23 years old, successful at what I did, and working 350 days a year. My life consisted of getting aboard airplanes and flying to different locations and studios all over the world. I rarely unpacked my suitcases. I just swapped my dirty clothes for clean ones, got back on the next plane, then turned around and did the same thing again 2 days later, and again 3 days after that. I began my mornings with a mocha frappuccino with whipped cream, along with the first of that day's pack of cigarettes. As for food, at that time I never gave any thought to what I put inside my body. Working in Japan when I was in my teens had introduced me to eating quickly and on the run. At night, when I came home to my New York apartment, I hung up my coat and poured myself a glass of wine. Afterwards, I still felt too wired from all the coffee and nicotine I'd had that day, and I needed something more to help me relax. What could be more natural than to polish off the rest of the wine bottle as I read a book or caught up on phone calls? I was a workaholic. In those days, I was living the opposite of a healthy lifestyle. I was living 100 miles per hour, smoking, drinking, eating badly, not sleeping much, and living pretty much out of a suitcase. It was intense. I was in transit all the time, either heading off or coming back from somewhere, which meant I never felt grounded or settled, or took the time to think about my life. It was just my life. And like a lot of people in their early 20s, I felt indestructible. Along with not knowing I was on a hamster wheel, I didn't understand that I was also basically relying on stimulants and depressants to get me through the day. Coffee to get me going in the morning, cigarettes to punctuate the long hours, and create a space for me at work without anyone, stylists, hair people, makeup people, touching me. Steak, burgers, French fries, pasta, pizza, candy, and whatever else to keep up my energy. Red wine to relax me and help me fall asleep. I didn't have my first drink until I was 19, but champagne was always available before a show. Very few designers offered any food for the models, which is why any time I spied food backstage, I filled my bag with it. After a while, it became my signature thing to go around giving out whatever snacks I had, sandwiches, crackers, candy, to the other models, most of whom, like me, had spent all day galloping from show to show, forgetting to eat. As I said, my life back then was go, go, go all the time. During show season, it was normal for me to wake up at 5 a.m. and not go to bed until 1 or 2 a.m., since after finishing work, as I mentioned earlier, I still had to do the fittings for the next day's shows, and then the shows after that. If I did the whole circuit, in those days, London, Milan, Paris, and New York, it was a marathon that would last a month. Invariably, I got sick toward the end, but not wanting to disappoint anyone, I pushed through, to the point of once almost fainting in the middle of the runway, and another time, getting so sick I had to fly home for a few days before the season ended. Looking back, I now see that I'd gone so numb I couldn't see what was happening. I was literally killing myself. I was poisoning my body from the moment I woke up in the morning to the moment I crashed at night. I was also creating a ripe environment for developing an anxiety problem. When you're 19 years old, maybe you can get away with working 350 days a year. But by the time you're 23 and have been running on overdrive for years, well, your body, mind, and soul begin breaking down. I was trying my best to cope with the realities of my life. What happened caught me by surprise, considering all the things I'd seen up to that point in my industry and all the traps I'd managed to avoid. When I left home at 14, obviously I was still very young, but for whatever reason I felt grown up and able to deal with adult challenges in my new adult world. Somehow I had always felt protected. I also knew that every decision I made affected me directly. I couldn't rely on my parents either. I was working all over the world, and my mom and dad were back home in Orizontina. Now, as a mother to small children, I can only imagine the worry my parents must have gone through. I am not sure they would even have let me go if they knew how crazy the world outside our small town could be. So many young female models seemed to be living in a hell that, as far as I could tell, they were unconsciously helping to create. Girls my own age, out of control at clubs, taking drugs, heading into dark places. I could have easily been one of them. Another model taking the 2 free drink chits and the ecstasy tablet from the guy standing outside the nightclub. But that was never me. As I said, something or someone always protected me. It might have been the voice of my mom, who, before I left home, told me never ever to accept anything, especially drinks, from strangers. In Tokyo, night after night, I saw the same thing. Teams of girls going out to clubs and getting wasted, and guys taking advantage of them. The whole time I felt like an observer, detached, as if I were looking at everything that was happening through a lens or a sheet of glass. Sometimes, as I walked to the subway on my way to work in the early morning, past groups of little black birds nibbling the garbage on the sidewalks, I'd see girls coming back from the clubs, looking sick and disoriented. I didn't understand how they could function. If staying away from that scene made me an outsider, fine. It wasn't a path I wanted to go down. If my roommate and I did go to a club, I'd order a soda while she flirted with the bartender she had a crush on. Afterward, I'd walk home and read a book. Clubbing, drinking, taking drugs, and staying out late never seemed to me like a very smart choice. I knew I would feel bad. People would take advantage of me, and I'd end up feeling broken. It wasn't for me. Also, my parents trusted me. They'd let me leave home so I could have a shot at this modeling thing, and I didn't want to do anything to disappoint them. I wanted them to be proud of me, and I also wanted to be a good example to my sisters. I enjoyed modeling, too. All the opportunities I was given to see the world and meet different, fascinating people. I also loved being able to shapeshift. Fashion is so varied. It's changeable and playful. Fake lashes and push-up bras one day, latex clothes and wigs the next, a string bikini and a bayonet the day after. It was like doing experiments on my identity. Who will I be today? Fashion appealed to my sense of limitlessness. I've never liked anyone defining me or telling me I'm this or I'm that. You're a model. Sit down. Don't say anything. Just be pretty. To my mind, I can be anything I want to be, and not one of those things involves being static or mute. The hard parts about modeling were the constant traveling, the promotional obligations including the launch parties, and the fact that, with the exception of my dog, Vida, it was difficult to make real friends. It felt lonely at times. When you make a mark in modeling, people aren't always happy for you. It can be a competitive, insecure business. More than once, I'd arrive at a show to find that they'd exchanged my shoes for a much bigger size, or a few times my heel broke in the middle of the runway, forcing me to walk on tiptoes, or my sandal straps would snap. But I'd smile and just keep walking down the runway as best I could, no matter what was thrown at me. The heels models wear on runways or during photo shoots are 7 or 8 inches tall, and walking in them is a real challenge. I'll bet every model out there has some kind of back problem. I know I do. Aside from my chronically dislocated shoulder, I have scoliosis and major issues with my knees that became worse after spending hours not only walking back and forth trying my best to balance in impossibly high heels, but also contorting my body during endless photo shoots, barely breathing while holding one unnatural position after the next and trying to look at ease. It's just not normal to spend 10 hours or more a day, day after day, in heels that high, and even less normal to jump in them. Because I was always jumping in photos. Some photographers would jokingly call me Sporty Spice. The reason why is simple. I had a lot of reservations about the way I looked. I didn't feel pretty at all. The one thing I felt I could do, the one thing that gave me confidence, was moving. If I was in motion in a photo, springing to life and creating some kind of movement or energy, I had more tools to fill out the story the photographer wanted to tell. But in truth, it was also a way of deflecting attention from my face. I didn't confront the toll all this was taking until my panic attacks started. I experienced the first in 2003. They would last for the next 9 months. It started with a plane ride in a small, cramped six-seater. I was flying with my friends at the time to Costa Rica. The weather that day was touch and go, and when the plane rose in the air, it began wobbling and shaking like a little leaf. "I'm going to die," I told myself. I flew all the time and didn't think anything of it, but suddenly I was intensely aware that I had no control. The fear of being trapped in a tiny space, of not being in charge, the overwhelming feeling that nothing in the world was steady or stable. Even though my friends were trying to distract me, I felt like I was going to pass out. When we landed, I could feel something had changed in me. I don't even remember what I did that weekend. All I remember is how frightened I was to take the plane home on Sunday. When I got back to New York, this new fear found other ways to show itself. It was as if it were moving from place to place, thing to thing, room to room. Suddenly, I didn't feel right about getting on elevators. I felt I couldn't breathe. I took the stairs instead. I felt the same way about tunnels. No way. I'd begun traveling again for work, but now I didn't want to go inside the hotels where I was staying. Walking through windowless lobbies made it too hard to breathe. I wouldn't get on the elevator. And I didn't want to be trapped in a hotel room, especially one with windows that didn't open. I couldn't go inside a modeling studio if it had no windows. Subways were out of the question. I began walking, or if I was in New York, riding my bike or taking taxis. The goal was to avoid being shut in and trapped. Looking back, it was more likely I was trying to outrun my own anxiety. As things got worse, I made an appointment with a specialist, and then another. Both were top physicians in New York. I left one office with a high-tech machine that tracked my breath. I was told to take it with me whenever I flew, sticking my finger inside as I breathed in and out while a wavy line rose and fell on a screen. It kept me from hyperventilating and getting the sweats, and it also served as a distraction. I brought the machine with me on every flight, but I didn't feel much changed. The same symptoms appeared every time. My hands would start sweating, followed by the familiar wet prickling sensation on my forehead. The back of my neck would get damp, then my hair. My breath started catching. I would feel lightheaded. Sometimes I would almost faint. Finally, things came to a crisis point. It was the weekend, and I was in my apartment in New York. I'd booked a massage to help me relax, aware that the muscles in my body were growing more tense every day. By now, my panic attacks, that's what my doctors were calling them, had been going on for nearly 6 months. At the time, I was living on West 11th Street and the West Side Highway, overlooking the river. My apartment was on the 9th floor. It was small but airy and full of light, with lots of windows and a big deck outside. But suddenly, in the middle of my massage, I just couldn't be there anymore. I couldn't catch my own breath. Making some excuse, I got up, pulled my towel around myself, and went outside onto the deck. It was a beautiful night. There was the water and the lights in the distance, and as much air as I needed, but I still couldn't find my breath. It felt like everything in my life was going to kill me. First it was airplanes, then elevators, then it was tunnels and hotels and modeling studios and cars. Now it was my own apartment. Everything had become a cage, and I was the animal trapped inside, panting for air. I couldn't see a way out, and I couldn't stand another day of feeling this way. The idea swept over me then. Maybe it will be easier if I just jump. It will be all over. There's a solution. I can get out of this. When I think back on that moment and that 23-year-old girl, I want to cry. She is so young, it almost breaks my heart. I want to tell her that everything will be all right, that she is too young to have any perspective or self-awareness, that she hasn't even begun to live her life. Up to that point, I'd always thought of myself as a happy, strong, positive, confident person. I wasn't born having panic attacks. I genuinely appreciated every blessing in my life. On the outside, it seemed like I had everything. I had the largest contract in fashion with Victoria's Secret. I had wonderful parents and sisters. I loved my boyfriend. I had great friends in New York who were my family away from home. But in that moment, the only answer seemed to be to jump. It is terrifying to see how suddenly despair can take over a brain and hijack it, just like that. Somehow I made it back inside my apartment. The idea of jumping was replaced by another thought, this one shaky but firm. Okay, Gigi, that's it. Now listen. Listen to yourself. Knowing I was in even worse trouble now, I went to my doctor first thing the next morning and told him what had happened. After grilling me to make sure I wasn't still suicidal, his response was to write me a prescription for Xanax. He gave me a sample pill to hold me over while I waited to fill my prescription at the drugstore. I remember staring at the pill in his hand. In spite of how defenseless I was feeling, I thought, I don't want to be dependent on a pill. I don't want to be dependent on anything outside myself. The idea made me even more anxious. What if I lose the pill? Then what happens? Something inside me knew somehow that I couldn't just put a band-aid over what was wrong with me. I have nothing against medicine, but when he offered me that pill, every cell in my body rose up in protest. I thought about my mother. She always looked for natural alternatives to cure any and all of our ailments when my sisters and I were growing up. She used to make teas for our sore throats or colds, and put cold towels on our foreheads and necks when one of us had a fever. Her methods had always worked, too. So what kind of tea could I make for this? I had seen people who had started off with just one pill, and in time started taking many more. I was scared and didn't want to go down that path. I knew there had to be another way. I had to figure it out, since after all, I'd always been the kind of person who wanted to master my fears. I had a choice to make, but it was also clear I couldn't go on feeling this anxious all the time. Somehow, although I didn't know how, I knew I had to find another way. When I left the doctor's office, I threw the medication in the trash. Some things you just know are true for yourself, or your body tells you. I don't know how your body knows those things, but it does. Having said that for myself, I acknowledge that we are all different, with different needs. For me, I knew I needed to trust my own intuition and handle my anxiety in the way I was most comfortable. I continued to follow my inner voice and always encourage every person to listen to their own. So I prayed. I prayed for clarity and for guidance about what I should do next. I asked to be shown the way. I did what I always do when I pray. I ask the same question over and over again until an answer appears. That night, I got my answer. Yoga. At the time, I wasn't looking for a thing. As I said, all I'd asked for was to be shown the way. Yoga. Where did yoga come from? I couldn't explain it. I still can't. I knew a little bit about yoga, of course. Years earlier, I'd read Autobiography of a Yogi by Yogananda, so it wasn't as though yoga was a foreign concept. Keep in mind, this was before yoga became mainstream like it is today. Still, I had no connection to that world. How could it possibly help me? But I must have associated yoga with peace or ease or balance. So the next morning, I started to look for an instructor. I also went online and began reading everything I could about yoga. Not just about the postures, but about the underlying philosophy. Yoga, I discovered, was a lot more than physical movements. It is a philosophy, a spiritual discipline that focuses on helping you know yourself better. Yoga comes from the Sanskrit word yuj, meaning to yoke or bind. Maybe it could help me yoke together my body and mind. Maybe it could help me with my panic attacks. I read more about the breathing techniques, pranayama especially, and about meditation. Meditation, like yoga, back then was just a word floating around in the culture. I'd never meditated in my life. Who had time? I was too busy. Even if you had the time, why would you bother? When I first met Amy, my new yoga instructor, she emanated a strong sense of serenity and trustworthiness as she walked into my apartment. First, we rearranged a few pieces of furniture, and then we sat on the floor using a mat. I told Amy that I had trouble breathing and that I was afraid to get on my own elevator, so I walked 9 flights of stairs instead, and that I was really scared that I was going to die. Amy started telling me about pranayama breathing. She asked me to press one finger against the middle of my forehead and use my thumb to seal my right nostril. "Breathe in," she said. "Now breathe out through your left. Now do it with your left nostril. Breathe in. Now breathe out through your right." She explained that the purpose of alternate nostril breathing, as it's known, is to balance the left and right sides of the brain, which helps you relax and get centered. She then showed me a few yoga postures. Even after only one meeting with Amy, I felt a difference. I wasn't so on edge anymore. It wasn't a miracle cure. I was still in pretty bad shape, and I had a long way to go. But Amy and I set up another meeting the next morning, and the next, and the next. I can't credit yoga entirely with the changes that took place in my life, but it helped a lot. It is still central to the life I lead today. As I said earlier, I've always liked to dig deeply into subjects that interest me, and the more I learned about yoga, the more pranayama breathing felt important for my healing. Prana is the universal life force. It's what distinguishes the living from the dead. It can be found in good quality foods, correct breathing, and positive thinking. Pranayama breathing just means controlling the universal life force through your breath, which in time helps bring balance and harmony to the body, the mind, and the spirit, or at least that's the goal. Many people in the West think of yoga as physical, a form of exercise focused around asanas or postures. In fact, the entire purpose behind practicing asanas is to stretch and open up our bodies to prepare them for meditation. With Amy as my teacher, I began practicing hatha yoga, the practice of physical postures. Though over the years, I've also experimented with ashtanga, kundalini, and other yogas. I love them all, but I always come back to hatha yoga because that's where I started. and it's so serene that I can be in a state of meditation while practicing. Plus, a gentle practice works best for me, since I do everything else in my life with intensity. But I'm getting ahead of myself. With Amy as my teacher, I began doing alternate nostril breathing every morning, right as the sun was coming up. It got easier with practice. Meditation helps to cultivate the feeling of being present. Presence means gifts, and for me, presence was the most amazing gift I could have received. Sometimes people ask me what role yoga plays in my life today. The simple answer is that, for me, yoga, like meditation, helps me remain present. When I get off a long plane ride, I may do a few simple sun salutations or hip openers. If I'm in Costa Rica and have the morning free, I like to do yoga with my friend Chris. I just love the exchange of energy that comes from practicing with another person. If I'm in the car and someone else is driving, I'll do my pranayama breathing in the back seat on the way to a studio, or while I'm listening to chants from devotional singers like Sanatan Kaur or Krishna Das, whose voices I listen to during both my pregnancies and the births of my children. Yoga can be helpful in so many ways. Whether it involves music or mantras or breath work or meditation, it is a powerful and beautiful spiritual practice. Yoga gave me back my life. It also motivated me to start looking inward. I decided to look closely, for the first time, at my life, to examine what was really going on with me and what role I was playing. How had I even reached this point? Why, with so many good things taking place in my life, at least on the surface, was so much else going wrong? Over the years, I've come to believe in the importance of positive attitudes. I believe that the quality of our life is directly linked to our attitudes. When my anxiety attacks started happening, people who knew me felt sorry for me. It would have been easy to buy into that way of thinking. Why is this happening to me? Poor me. Why am I having anxiety attacks? I'm such a good person. But if I did that, I would have seen myself as a victim. And I've always believed that when you start seeing yourself as a victim, you surrender your power, and it can be hard to get it back. From the practice of yoga and meditation, I was able to see things from a different perspective. I began to ask myself, Giselle, why is this situation happening for you? There's an opportunity here. What can you learn from this? What is the lesson here? In no way do I mean to say that if you are experiencing anxiety or depression, that you should not ask for help. I did. I also know now that the early 20s are an especially vulnerable time of life. Adolescence is difficult, but your 20s, when you're still discovering who you are and what you're good at and where your life is going, can be even harder. Young women and men can find themselves experiencing distress they've never experienced before, and they can't understand why. If that is you, get help. It can save your life. But I didn't know that then. I'd been in charge of myself since I was 14, and as far as I was concerned, there was only one person who could rescue me. Me. I learned that the only way I could begin that rescue mission was by changing the conversation inside my head. When I began wondering, why is this happening to me? A big shift in my thinking got underway. Over the next few days and weeks, I began to see myself and my life more clearly. As I started to improve, I asked myself another question. How am I going to deal with this opportunity that life has given me to learn about myself? Around that time, I remember having the strangest feeling. I was falling away from myself and from my ego, as if they were a pair of structures toppling slowly into the surf. Life was showing me something, and its message couldn't have been clearer. It was up to me now whether I wanted to see what life was showing me, or to hop back on the hamster wheel. It felt like I was being called on to reject everything that wasn't supporting or benefiting me, and to embrace everything that was. For example, I told myself that if I was having trouble breathing, it might be a good idea to stop smoking. I'd started when I was 17, sweet cigarettes at first, though pretty soon I was hooked on the regular ones, up to a pack a day. Whenever I wanted to fit in somewhere or try to look cool, I'd light one up. I'd tried quitting a couple of times, made bets with friends, seen an acupuncturist, and read books about stopping, but with no success. Now I told myself the cigarettes had to go. So I stopped, just like that. I began running, too, 30 minutes every morning, even when it was raining or snowing. It was partly to help with not smoking, but mostly to form a healthier habit. Nothing makes you feel your lungs more than a good hard run. My new focus on breathing opened me up to new ways of thinking about my other habits and routines, especially my habit of always being on the go, traveling, pursuing, answering phone calls and texts and emails, working all night and every weekend, feeling guilty if I took even one day off, telling myself